Welcome to Sundays with Papa Jeff. If you're listening live, this is bbsradio.com, and my name is Jeff Bellier. If you're listening to the CD or MP3 or the archives, welcome to the audiobook version of Sunrise of Two Lions. My radio show, Sundays with Papa Jeff, is for travelers and seekers on the mystic path, and it occurred to me that my book, Sunrise of Two Lions, is also about a pathway to personal transformation, so I've decided to incorporate an audiobook version into my show over the next few weeks. Sunrise of Two Lions is set on the coast of Maine. It's where my wife and I used to live. It's a book of visionary fiction. Billy King Fraser, age 10, is reported missing. And after 90 days, he returns to our startled family with an even more startling story. Contained within this story of visionary fiction are real-world lessons about taming the lions, the inner lions, of fear and doubt, enjoying peace of mind, and achieving clarity about life's purpose. So welcome to the audio version of Sunrise of Two Lions. I'm going to begin with the introduction, as you would read it in the book. The book is available on the internet at www.mindgoal, that's do you have a goal in mind, mindgoal, mindgoal.com, and also available on amazon.com. And here's how the book begins. I don't know these people. I don't know how much of any of this story is true. I only know what I heard from a fellow traveler, a storyteller, on an Amtrak train ride from Baltimore to Boston. This was a train ride that should have taken hours, yet in what seemed to be minutes, the ride was over, and we pulled into South Station in Boston. It was as if something in the story or in my own mind had collapsed time. When we came to a stop at the station, the storyteller handed me a thin little book. On each page in the book, there was one unusual painting, and on the back of each painting, there was a narrative verse, a poem, to go along with the painting. I stood up to put the book in my overcoat pocket. When I sat back down, the storyteller was gone. But his words were sealed in my mind, and his book was in my pocket. So I guess I've decided to be a storyteller too. And now you're listening to this book. The story begins back in the 1970s when a young boy from Maine was reported as missing in the dead of winter. 90 days later to the day, the boy who had been missing and given up for dead was spotted walking along the side of a country road and, I am led to believe, told of a most amazing adventure. The details of his episode and the incredible tale of what happened to him while he was missing, those that can be put into words, are contained within the story you're about to read. Chapter 1, Gone Fishing. Billy, get up. Your breakfast is getting cold. That was Nana Fraser's everyday wake-up call. A few seconds later, she always added, "You better get up, Billy. You'll be late." Today, she added, "Your dad will be here any minute." Nana always fudged about the time just to get Billy in motion, and he knew it. But today, he bounced out of bed as soon as he heard Nana's voice. Billy was going ice fishing with his father, and Billy remembered how hungry he got out on the ice all day the last time they went, so he wanted to make sure he didn't miss breakfast. 2 eggs, sunny side up, bacon well done, dark toast, orange juice, and a bowl of cornflakes, if he still had room. That was Billy's usual breakfast. It had been just about every day since he came to live with his grandparents 4 years before when he was 6 years old. Nana would sit out his breakfast on the kitchen table just the way he liked it, bacon and eggs first, juice, toast, and cereal second. Then she would open the door to the stairs, and call him to breakfast. Billy's room was right at the top of the stairs, and Nana's high, shrill voice was always amplified as it shut up the enclosed curved stairway into Billy's room. "Billy!" The second call could reach near eardrum-piercing levels. Billy was usually ready for it with his ears covered, but this morning he didn't have to cover his ears. He was on his way down the stairs at first call. "You better dress really warm. It's freezing cold," Nana said as Billy pulled his chair up to the morning banquet. "Mm-hmm," he acknowledged with a half slice of toast he'd already packed into his mouth in one bite. "And slow down. You'll get a stomachache." "Mm-hmm." Billy heard the Jeep pull into the driveway just as he was slurping the last few gulps of sweet milk from his cereal bowl. He dropped the bowl on the table, disappeared up the back stairs, and reappeared with his plastic tackle box before the bowl had stopped spinning. "Bye, Nan," he shouted as he slammed the kitchen door. "Thanks for breakfast. See you tonight. Fish for dinner. You'll have to clean them first. Hey, you didn't say goodbye to Grandpa." Billy didn't answer back. He heard her, but he wasn't about to come back in and say goodbye to his grandfather. Too many times, Grandpa had found an excuse at the last minute to ground Billy and ruin his plans. It happened a lot. So Billy was out of the door. He wasn't about to come back. Anyway, Nan knew she'd end up cleaning the fish. She always did when Ron and Billy went fishing. And she knew why Billy hadn't said goodbye to Grandpa, especially when Billy's plans included Ron. Ron, that's Billy's father, didn't come into the house. He never did. Billy's grandfather wouldn't allow it, but that's another story. Today, Billy's going ice fishing. "Hi, Dad," Billy chirped as he tossed his tackle box into the back of the Jeep. "Hey, Rascal, how you doing?" Rascal was the nickname that Ron gave to Billy when he saw him for the very first time in the maternity ward of the hospital where Billy was born. Ron, Rachel, and Rascal, that was the happy young King Fraser family, at least for a few years. Ron King and Rachel Fraser grew up across the street from each other on Winter Hill in Gardner, Maine. Rachel was a tomboy. She was just considered one of the boys by Ron, at least until they were older. Rachel could hit a baseball farther and run faster than most of the boys in the neighborhood until well into high school. Ron was an easygoing kid, a mediocre student, usually a bench warmer in sports, who skipped school a lot to go fishing as soon as the weather turned warm enough. That's early spring in Maine. His father had been killed in a hunting accident when Ron was really young. It seems his father and a friend went out for a pheasant one day, and as they walked across the field, one flew up. The friend wheeled around and fired off a shot at the bird. Problem was, Ron's father was standing between his friend and the bird. So Ron grew up without a father around. He had a really good relationship with his mother, though, and she pretty much devoted her life to her son. She never had any more kids, and she never remarried. Ron promised himself that if he ever had children, he'd be sure that he'd stick around to raise them. But that's not the way it turned out. After he and Rachel got married, now that was a real surprise to everybody. It seemed like overnight things changed between Ron and Rachel. They were seniors in high school, still buddies, who hung out at each other's house like they had for years, listening to music, making snacks together, and emptying their family's respective refrigerators. Rachel would help Ron with his studies, and Ron would listen, somewhat patiently, as Rachel would read out loud to him to help him finish an assigned book or prepare for a test. The next thing anybody knew, out of the blue, they were talking about getting married. No one knew what happened all of a sudden, but there was plenty of speculation in this small, gossipy town. Anyway, when Rachel's father heard about it, he went through the roof. He had more than a few times referred to Ron's family as good-for-nothing bums. Rachel had heard it and always just shrugged it off, but when she and Ron stood in front of her father and nonchalantly announced that they were talking about getting married, he exploded. He grabbed Ron by the arm and neck and literally threw him out of the house. From that point on, Ron never came into Rachel's house. Ron and Rachel sneaked around to see each other for the rest of the school year, and 7 days out of high school, they took off together and eloped. They came back to Ron's house a few days later on a Saturday, and Ron's mother took the news like it was no big deal at all. As soon as they told her what they had done, she reached over and gave Rachel a big hug and asked if they were going to live at home with her for a while. She was a very cool customer. It would not be the same reception at Rachel's house, not by a long shot. Rachel called her mother from Ron's house and cheerfully announced that she and Ron had eloped. You could feel the anguish from across the street, let alone over the telephone. "Your father will kill you," Rachel's mother whispered painfully into the phone. She always worried about her husband and his reactions because he had such an explosive temper. She was always telling everybody in the family to keep their voice down, just in case they would inadvertently say anything to upset the old grouch. "Where are you right now?" the man demanded. With that, and without a response, Rachel calmly hung up the phone and stormed across the street into her house. Her father was in the living room watching a ball game, and he didn't even hear the door slam. Rachel's mother did, though, and she tried to stop Rachel from going into the living room. The mother pleaded silently, shaking her head, that Rachel would not be stopped. She was always a spitfire, and more than a few times growing up, let her father know that he wasn't going to bully her the way he did everyone else. She marched into the living room and stood between her father and the television. That was a definite no-no to begin with, so she really had her defiant face on. Before he could say a word, she blurted at him, "Ronnie and I got married, and if you don't like it, well, that's just too damn bad. I'm 18, I'm out of here." Father tried to respond. His face turned beet red. He gripped the sides of his chair like he was going to pounce, and then, to Rachel's stunned amazement, he broke down in tears. Rachel had never seen her father show any sign of weakness, let alone tears. He was a tough boss, a tough husband, and a tough disciplinarian. He never hit her, but he never hugged her either. She had never seen him so much as touch her mother, but here he was with tears coming down his face. She didn't know what to do, but that didn't last long. In the next instant, her father's eyes turned cold. His jaw clenched, and he actually spit the words out of there. "Get out of my sight." Fine with me. They didn't speak to each other until 2 years later when Billy was born and after much pleading from Rachel's mother. In the hospital, the sight of Billy absolutely melted Rachel's father. He still wouldn't even acknowledge Ron, but his face softened for a quick instant, and he actually reached over and touched his daughter's arm as she held Billy. Rachel and her father never really connected closely, but at least there was civil peace between them again. 6 years later, Ron and Rachel decided to separate. Ron was a stick in the mud, and Rachel was full of energy. The resentment between them was beginning to show, and they each knew it. So quietly and amicably, they worked out the terms of a divorce, and not surprisingly, they were able to stay friends. They even laughed and joked at how they were much better friends than they were marriage partners. Rachel had always wanted to travel, see Europe and the rest of the world, but Ron didn't want Billy to be away from him for so long periods of time, so that's how Billy came to live with his grandmother and grandfather. It was only supposed to be for a few weeks while Rachel traveled, but Rachel quickly learned to love her freedom and the ability to move around whenever she wanted, and Anna liked having someone to wait on besides the old grouch. So, with Billy off fishing with his father, Anna had started cleaning up the kitchen. She stopped to put more coffee on and hollered to Grandpa to ask if he wanted a warm-up. It was a Saturday morning, so he was home from work. No answer. She kicked her voice up to that shrill and tone and tried one more time. Grandpa, you want a warm-up? The old grouch was in his chair in the living room watching the morning news, and he'd heard Billy and Anna talking. A lot of times, Grandpa would bellow from the living room and ask whoever was talking in the kitchen what they were whispering about. Other times, you could yell in his ear, and he'd make believe he didn't hear you. No one really believed he was all that hard of hearing, so they were usually pretty careful about what they said, especially about Grandpa. For God's sake, you don't have to yell so loud the neighbors will hear you. Yes, I want a warm-up. Hey, Billy, bring Grandpa his slippers, will you? Grandpa finally called back from the living room. He's already gone fishing with Ron, Nana said as she poured the coffee into the cup he was holding. Grandpa scowled and put his socks back on. In less than a minute, Nana came scurrying with his slippers. When she tried to help him put them on, he yanked them out of her hands and put them on himself with a lot of sighing and huffing and puffing, like he always did when things didn't go exactly his way. Chapter 2, The Disappearance of Billy. Rachel's family owned a camp on Tacoma Lake that had been in the family for three generations. Ron had always loved going out there to fish and just relax since before he graduated from high school. So even though their marriage hadn't worked out and Rachel's father didn't like Ron one bit, Anna gave Ron a key and told him to take Billy to the camp whenever Billy wanted to go. Ron parked at the top of the hill leading to the camp so they wouldn't get stuck in the bottom of the hill on the snow and ice. They carried their backpacks, fishing gear, and cooler down the hill past the cabin to the lake, while Ron's Irish setter, Queenie, jumped and barked and ran around them as they made their way. Queenie loved coming out to the lake where she could run free through the woods. She was too hyper for Billy's liking. They walked over to where the big pine trees, maple, and white birches hung out over the lake. In the summer, the water was usually a lot cooler in this spot because a thick grouping of trees blocked the sun from ever hitting that part of the lake directly. It was a great spot to cool off on a hot summer day, and they could go over just a few yards to the clearing when they wanted to sunbathe and enjoy warmer weather. Ron cut a few branches from a low-hanging pine tree and put most of the stuff on top of the branches to keep it off the snow-covered ground. Then he rubbed his gloved hands together and said to Billy, "Let's do it." Ron reached out and put his hands on Billy's chest and stopped him just before they stepped out on the ice. There had been a January thaw for the past few days, and even though they were in the shaded area, Ron wanted to be sure the ice was safe. So he walked out a few steps, then jumped up and down hard a few times. He thought he heard a crack, but tried several times more and didn't hear it again. So he motioned Billy to come on out. It was almost noon before the flags were finally all set. Billy and Ron had set out about a dozen flags. If you're not familiar with ice fishing, it's done by chopping a round hole about a foot or so in diameter in the ice, which by the time it's safe to walk in is nearly a foot thick. A chopping is done with a heavy iron bar with a chiseled end. It can take quite a bit of time and definitely requires concentration. Inattentive people have been known to chop off a toe or two. Once the hole is cut, you just drop a line in and wait. People who fish are people who are very good at waiting. The fishing line is attached to a little red flag on a wooden stick, which is bent over in a half a circle and spring-loaded. When a fish takes the hook, the pole releases the flag, which then pops up to let you know that a fish is on the line. They had been out on the ice on Tacoma Lake for about 2 hours, chopping away at the ice. Billy was down to his t-shirt because of the sweat he had worked up chopping ice. The sun was unusually warm this day, but his feet were freezing and he was hungry. So he was really glad to see his father open the thermos, pour a couple of cups of hot cocoa, and unwrap two sandwiches. Queenie, who had been running through the woods like she always did when they came to the lake, immediately appeared, running and sliding on the ice. She came right over beside Billy when she saw him take a bite of ham sandwich. Billy lifted his sandwich and turned away so Queenie wouldn't snatch away from him. "No, Queenie, sit," Billy tried, to no avail, as Queenie ran around to get even closer to his sandwich. But when Ron spoke, Queenie sat down on her haunches and just licked her chops while Billy began to eat his sandwich. "I'm not giving you any, Queenie," Billy snapped. Billy loved baked ham sandwiches, and he was picking around the edges, sipping on his cocoa, saving every bite of his ham sandwich until he could chomp into the delicious, thickest, tastiest part in the middle. "Hey, Billy, there one goes." Billy set his Coca down carefully on top of the cooler, wrapped his sandwich quickly, set it down too, and sprinted for the flag. He was hoping for a nice big bass. A pickle would be good, but they're kind of bony. A white perch would be edible, but definitely not his favorite. And if it were a yellow perch, which is just about all bones, he'd just throw it back. It was none of these. False alarm. The line was empty. Sometimes the pickle would hit the line so hard they would snap it. Damn it, Billy sputtered, then looked around quickly to make sure his father hadn't heard him. As it turned out, Billy looked just in time to see Queenie make off with the best part of his sandwich. Damn it, Queenie! Lauren just smiled and shook his head in mock disgust, then he burst out laughing. That made Billy laugh, too. Maybe it was the cold, the fact they were very tired, or maybe because of Billy's relief that he didn't get in trouble for saying what he said. But anyway, they were both soon rolling in the ice, laughing and holding onto their stomachs like, as Grandpa often said, a couple of damn fools. Three pickle, no bass, and about 2 dozen white perch later, they packed it in. It was starting to get dark, and they had quite a long walk to get back to the hill where they parked the Jeep. When they made it to the top of the rise, they saw a very faint beam from the Jeep headlights. Ron had forgotten to turn the lights off, and sure enough, the battery was deader than a mackerel. So there was no electricity or phone at the camp, and this was before cell phones. They had no choice. They had to stay in the cabin for the night and go for help in the morning. So they cooked some of the day's catch over the fireplace and drank the rest of the cocoa. Ron found plenty of blankets and they wrapped up, snuggled together next to the fireplace, and went to sleep. A few hours later, Billy had to go to the bathroom so badly he had no choice but to brave the pitch black of night and trudge through the snow to the outhouse. When he came out, he somehow got turned around and headed off away from camp. He didn't realize it until he came out to a flat clearing, and he knew he'd gone the wrong way. He thought he was at the open edge of the lake, but he wasn't. He was several feet out on it. He heard the ice crack, and somehow he knew it was too late to do anything about it. He stood absolutely still in the spot and inhaled a quick gulp of air. Then, like a shot, he dropped through the ice. With his lungs full of air, he quickly bobbed back up, but he hit thicker ice, face up, farther out into the lake. He punched at the ice above, and held his breath as long as he could. He used to practice holding his breath in the swimming pool back in Anderson, and he was really good at it, but sooner or later he had to let it go. When he finally did, though, his breath didn't go anywhere. Billy was face up under the ice, eyes shut tight, cheeks puffed way out, and now he was frozen solid. During the night, a light snowfall covered Billy's tracks and his whereabouts. When Ron woke up at about 7 a.m., he looked for Billy somewhere in the pile of blankets. No Billy. When he didn't find him anywhere in the cabin, he went outside to look for him. Ron thought he probably was getting something out of the Jeep or he was in the outhouse, but by now it was snowing hard and you couldn't see more than a few feet in front of you. Billy, Ron shouted several times, and he checked the Jeep and the outhouse. No Billy. For a while, Ron wasn't worried at all. He figured Billy was checking something in the woods and Queenie would find him in no time. But Queenie came back from her romp alone, and after about a half hour, Ron became concerned. Ron walked to the top of the hill, shouted Billy's name over and over for about another 10 minutes, and then started to walk around the lake. Still no Billy. Ron was beginning to get very worried and a little frantic. He decided to walk out to the road and hitchhike into Gardner for a phone and for someone to help him start his Jeep. He thought, or at least hoped, that Billy would be safely back in the cabin by the time he got back. The first car to come by didn't see Ron through the snowstorm until they got really close. They swerved away and just beeped the horn, waved, and kept on going. The second vehicle to come by was a police cruiser, and he stopped. In less than an hour, about 30 or 40 people were walking the woods and the edges of the lake looking for Billy. A couple of them started to go out on the ice to get a better look at into a section of the woods, but scurried off the ice when they heard a crack once or twice. For some strange reason, it never occurred to them what had happened to Billy. Days went by, weeks went by. Still no Billy. There was a gloom and sadness that hung in the air after Billy's disappearance that the families couldn't shake. Even the normally boisterous and rowdy Fraser family couldn't let it go. Ron's mother openly took it really hard. Nana's stoic French-Canadian upbringing prevented her from showing too much emotion, but she missed Billy terribly. The local and statewide news ran stories of Billy's disappearance almost every day for about a month. The second month, the stories died down. By the third month, Billy was given up for dead by just about everybody but Nana. She insisted that something in her bones told her Billy was alive and he would be back. It was just a quiet family affair. Memorial service. Nana refused to go. It was just a quiet really sad. And Ron's mother was the only one who could stop crying long enough to even say a few words. After that, life went back to its usual routine, except for the black cloud that hung in the air. All of that was about to change. Exactly 90 days from that fateful ice fishing trip, on a bright and sunny April day in May, as the noonday sun beat down on Tacoma Lake, an extraordinary event took place. Billy's tightly closed eyes and puffed out cheeks were just below the surface of the wafer-thin ice. Everything was still and quiet, except for a few early robins chirping. Then, in a startling instant, Billy's eyes sprung open wide, and a fierce exhale burst out through the thin ice. By some miracle of hibernation or cryogenics or some such thing, Billy was alive. As soon as his breath let go, he came thrashing up and out of the water, crashing through the surface and splashing his way until he was up on the grass and pine needles at the edge of the lake. "Dad," he started shouting over and over, as if what happened to him just happened a few minutes ago. He got up, ran to the cabin, and pushed open the door before reality hit him. He spun around to see bare ground outside. It wasn't winter anymore. Dad and Queenie and the Jeep were gone. He thought he was going to faint, but a cold chill running down to his bones snapped him out of it. He took off his wet clothes, wrapped himself up in one of the blankets on the floor, and looked for some paper to start the fireplace. In just a few minutes, the fireplace was blazing, and Billy was beginning to feel the shivers that kept coming every few seconds slow down. His mind had been so much on getting the fire going and getting warm that he hadn't had time to think. But as he slowly warmed up, he began to get flashes of what seemed like a dream. As his mind tried to reconcile what was happening, he was distracted again, this time by hunger pangs. He found canned beans and some cold cereal left over from last summer. He ate the beans cold and the stale cereal dry, then he fell asleep. When he woke up, the fireplace was down to smoldering ashes, and his clothes were just about dry. His boots were still pretty wet, so he lit the stove and tucked them in the gas oven, and hung his pants over the door of the oven. He checked on his boots every few minutes. When they were dry, slipped his still chilled feet into the toasty warm boots. He was still really confused, still shivering every so often, and still really hungry. Now he wanted desperately to go home, so he made his way out to the edge of the road and started walking. It was very quiet along the road, no traffic at all. The warm afternoon sun felt nice on his back, and the quiet gave him time to think. His mind flashed to a picture of a mansion or a castle at the end of a long driveway. He heard the sound of ocean waves crashing on the shore, and soft classical music. None of it made any sense to him. He hadn't walked more than several hundred yards before he realized how incredibly weak he felt. He stopped walking and leaned against a fence that enclosed a rolling pasture on the side of the road. He felt dizzy and tried to shake it off, but stumbled and fell on the gravel at the edge of the paved road. The next thing he heard was the sound of a car stopping and a car door opening and closing. "Young man, are you all right?" someone excitedly repeated several times before he could respond. Looking up, he saw a woman who looked like one of his old school teachers leaning over him. "I saw you take a fall just as I was coming by. Do you need a ride to be home?" Then she repeated, "Are you all right?" No sooner were the words out of her mouth than she recognized Billy. She gasped, mouth open, and seemed to go into a freeze frame for what seemed like a full minute to Billy. She looked like she had seen a ghost, was all he could think. "Billy? Billy? My God, you're Billy Frazier. Is that really you, Billy? Can you give me a ride to Nana's?" Billy asked sheepishly. He wasn't sure what the fuss was all about. "He just stumbled, that's all." "Yeah, I'm okay." Mrs. Littlefield, who had been Billy's fourth-grade teacher, kept looking over at Billy, but only said, "My God," over and over as they drove to Billy's house. When they pulled in the driveway, Billy jumped out of the car and ran in through the kitchen door. Chapter 3, Billy's Home. As Billy came into the kitchen, Nana was leaning over, taking an apple pie out of the oven. Now, you remember Nana had a high-pitched voice. Well, she had high-pitched emotions and energy to go along with her voice. "Hi, Nan, I'm starving," were the first words out of Billy's mouth, like he'd just come in from playing outside for a while. Nana jumped at the sound of his voice, but managed to hold on to the hot apple pie she was taking out of the oven. As she looked up with a disgusted scowl on her face, as if he had scared her out of her wits, as she liked to say, her expression changed from scowling to horrified. She was sure she had seen a ghost. This time, she didn't hold on to the pie. She startled so violently that she flipped the pie in Billy's direction. It smacked on the floor and slid to a stop at his feet. He was so famished and disoriented that he didn't stop to think. He scooped up some of the piping hot pie and stuffed it into his mouth. Just as the burning sensation in his tongue and throat, he felt the sting of a ferocious slap to his face. A deafening, blood-curdling screech of his name immediately followed that, and it was all too much. Billy passed out. "Billy! Billy! Billy!" Nana screamed and cried. The whole unbelievable scene made her feel like she was really going out of her wits this time. If Mrs. Littlefield hadn't come through the door the next second, Nana might have really lost her mind. "I saw him walking out near Tacoma Lake. I didn't know who he was at first. He stumbled and fell on the side of the road, so I stopped to see if he was all right. Is he all right? I can't believe it's Billy Billy. And once more, is he all right?" Nana looked up with a crazed expression. She was tightly gripping handfuls of hair on the top of her head with both hands and looked like she could pull out clumps of hair any second. She looked like she had gone absolutely insane. The sound of Mrs. Littlefield's voice was probably the only thing that kept her from completely losing it. She was making grunting and snarling sounds and holding her teeth clenched together. Mrs. Littlefield knelt down beside her and put her arm around her to calm her down. The sounds Nana was making were getting louder and more hysterical until Billy opened his eyes for just a second, said, "I'm sorry, Nana," and closed them again. Nana snapped out of it, shook him, and he opened his eyes again. He had a dazed expression, but managed a faint smile. "Oh, Billy, I didn't mean to hit you. You scared the wits out of me. Where have you been? What happened to you? What?" "Nana, can I have some water? My mouth hurts a lot," Billy pleaded. Mrs. Littlefield asked if she could call Dr. Matthews. Nana thought for a minute. She hated calling doctors. She was an herbalist of sorts and had great faith in the body's ability to heal itself. This time she relented and asked Mrs. Littlefield if she would call and see when the doctor could come over. After Mrs. Littlefield convinced Dr. Matthews that it was really Billy, and no, they couldn't bring him to the office or the hospital, he was in bed exhausted, Dr. Matthews agreed to come over. He said he'd be there at the end of the day, around 5:30. Nana called Ron, then Ron's mother. Finally, she placed a long-distance call to Rachel in Florida. Ron's mother came in from across the street first. She cried and cried and cried at the sight of Billy. He was sitting up and smiled a weak smile without a word. When she hugged him, he patted her gently on the back and said softly, "I'm okay, Grandma, I'm okay." "Where have you been, Billy? What happened to you?" Ron's mother asked. So Billy just looked kind of dazed and confused by the question. It took him a long time to answer, but finally he spoke. "I fell through the ice." Ron came crashing through the front door, almost ripping it off its hinges, and running through the kitchen. He saw Nana and Mrs. Littlefield looking into the downstairs bedroom off the kitchen and slowed down just enough not to knock them over. When he looked in and saw Billy sitting on the bed, Ron hesitated for a brief moment and then in one leap landed on the bed. This bounced Billy up and into Ron's arms. Ron held on tightly and kept rubbing the back of Billy's head. "Thank you, God, oh, thank you, God," Billy cried over and over. Ron cried over and over. His mother and Nana looked at each other with a subdued smile. They were both churchgoers, but Ron never really wanted anything to do with it. Hadn't been to church since he was a kid. The tears started, the crying started, then the relieved laughter started. Soon, Nana and Ron's mother were all hugging and rocking Billy at the same time. Mrs. Littlefield looked a little uneasy for a few seconds, but then joined in the group hug, all of them laughing and crying. "What's going on here?" a voice boomed. Billy's grandfather had come home. Nana looked up first. "It's Billy. Billy's home. He's okay. Dr. Matthews is coming over." Billy's grandfather didn't acknowledge what Nana had said. He glared at Ron and said, "You had him all the time, didn't you? You..." His high pitch reached a new level. "You shut up. You just shut up. Shut up. Shut up. Shut up." Now that stunned everybody, probably including Nana. She never confronted Billy's grandfather. But this time, she was worried more about Billy than his grandfather, and she let him have it. His face went its usual beet red, warning light color to signal the oncoming explosion, but he didn't say a word back. He turned, walked out, slamming the door behind him and chirping the ties like an angry teenager as he drove away. Dr. Matthews turned in the driveway about this time, glanced back at the car roaring down Winter Hill, got out of his car and walked into the house. Nana heard the door and readied herself for the coming barrage she expected, but when she saw it was Dr. Matthews, she breathed a sigh of relief and grabbed the doctor's sleeve to pull him into Billy's room. "He seems fine. Everything's normal. A little skinny, but other than that, he's healthy," was the doctor's good pronouncement. "The only problem is, he has absolutely no recall of the past 90 days, except for falling through the ice on the lake. His memory should come back, though, and it could come back any time, either gradually over time or in a sudden flash. But it most probably will come back. Of course, a traumatic event can sometimes wipe out the memory entirely. We'll just have to wait and see. If you like, I'll have him taken to the hospital for a few tests, just to be sure there was no brain damage or internal injury, but he seems to be just fine." Nana abruptly refused the hospital test option and put on water for tea. Mrs. Littlefield and Dr. Matthews agreed to have some tea with Nana while Ron stayed to talk with Billy. Ron's mother remembered that she had left something on the stove and quickly zipped out the door, saying she would be back in a few minutes. While she waited for the water to heat up, Nana started mixing up pancakes for Billy. So what happened? We were going nuts. I fell through the ice. That's all I remember. I made it to shore, and you were gone. When did you fall through the ice, Ron asked. When I got up to go to the yacht house. We were staying at the camp. It was really dark. I got turned around, I guess. Went when the jeep wouldn't start. Last night, you know. Ron paled. He told Billy they had gone ice fishing in January. It was back then that the jeep wouldn't start because he had left the lights on. But that was 3 months ago. That was 3 months ago, not last night. It's April, Billy. You've been gone for 3 months. We thought you had been kidnapped or killed or something. We've been going crazy. Where were you for 3 months? Billy just stared blankly and started to cry. He couldn't remember anything except falling through the ice and holding his breath for as long as he could. I tried to find you, Dad. I looked everywhere, but you were gone. I was soaking wet, and I had to dry my clothes, and I fell asleep, and then I started walking. It's okay, Billy. It's okay. We're just glad you're home. Can I get something to eat, please? I'm starved. No sooner had Billy spoken the words than Nana appeared carrying a breakfast tray with a stack of pancakes on it. Also on the tray was a cup of maple syrup that she had warmed up in the oven for a few minutes, just the way Billy liked, and a tall glass of cold milk. After Dr. Matthews and Mrs. Littlefield left, Nana poured herself another cup of tea and pulled the kitchen chair up beside Billy's bed. Ron was still sitting on the bed, just smiling and watching Billy wolf down his pancakes. Every so often, Ron would shake his head slightly and quickly wipe away the first sign of a tear. Did you call Rachel? He asked Nana. Of course, Ron. She's on her way from Florida. Mom's coming home, Billy squeaked. Nana popped her eyes wide open, chagrin. Yes. Well, look, Billy, Nana said lovely, pointing into her empty teacup. You've been on a long journey, and there's a little dog trailing you. Nana was not only an herbalist. One of the talents for which she was most well known was that she read tea leaves. It was a long-standing topic of conversation and jokes among all of her family and friends. And, of course, Grandpa would never have anything to do with any of it. But rarely did anyone in the family or circle of friends visit without a request for a reading. And Nana was always willing to accommodate. It was one of those things that you pretend to mock, but you're all you use when it's about you. Let me see, Nana. Billy looked into the usual nondescript, except to Nana, scattering of tea leaves at the bottom of the teacup. Nana pointed at a section and went on with the story of what she saw. She saw this long, winding road, a young man carrying a sack over his shoulder, and a little dog jumping up near the young man. In the distance, she saw a castle. See, she kept saying as she told the story, a young man is on this long and winding road. A little dog is his companion, and they are approaching a castle. Now, a castle is a very powerful and magical symbol. It stands for strength and authority and wisdom, and it is very well protected so that nothing can come against it. The little dog jumping and barking represents those thoughts we have when we're not sure about something, or when something is nagging at us, like things we wish we hadn't done, or when we're afraid of something that is about to happen. Anna looked up from her reading. Billy had stopped chewing his pancakes and was staring off into space with his mouth still full. He sat motionless as he just listened to Nana's reading. Did you remember something, Billy? Nana asked, with his stillness. I was just listening, Nana. I could hear some really soft music while you were talking. Weird. Hello? Came Ron's mother's voice as she walked in the kitchen. How's my Billy? I'm fine, Grammy. She peeked in to see him and said she'd be back after dinner to visit with him if that was all right. Later in the evening, Billy moved to the living room couch, still wrapped in a couple of blankets. He spent the evening watching television. Anna brought in snacks for him and Ron every so often, and Ron sat at Billy's feet, rubbing them to keep them warm, had to make physical contact with the sun he thought he had lost forever. The following day, Nana was in the kitchen cooking dinner. At 5 p.m. on the dot, Grandpa came through the door. He had stayed out all night. He glared at Nana standing over the stove, and his cold expression dared her to say something. She didn't. She just pointed to the dinner, already to the table, already set for dinner. It's almost ready. Sit down. Grandpa stood where he was to make a point that he wasn't about to jump just because she spoke. Anna caught his lingering expression and thought to herself that she certainly knew where Rachel got that imperious look. The kitchen door forcefully swinging open, and smacking Grandpa on the backside interrupted the studied imperial look. Rachel was home. Billy! She screamed. Grandpa had bent forward and grabbed the kitchen table to keep his balance after the door hit him. So his left ear was right at the height of Rachel's mouth when she screamed. Grandpa's instinctive reaction to lift his hand to protect his ear was enough to throw him off balance. He tumbled onto the edge of the table, flipping it up and knocking everything off as he crashed to the floor in the midst of broken dishes and spilled food. Billy came running out of the living room to greet his mother. Ron came right behind him, and the three of them hugged tightly and stood locked together, rocking each other, crying. Nana watched with an adoring look, tears welling up in her eyes. Grandpa sat on the floor, stunned for a minute, and then he did something completely unexpected for a grouch. He broke into an uproarious laugh. That stunned everyone else. Rachel, Ron, Billy, and Nana all turned to look at Grandpa sitting on the floor in a mess. He had mashed potato in his hair, a piece of a broken serving dish delicately balanced on the top of his head, and a huge gravy stain making its way down the shoulder of his crisply starched white shirt. Talk about comic relief. Nana fell against the kitchen wall, laughing so hard that she started coughing and choking as she did a slow-motion slide down to her knees on the floor. Ron was beside himself laughing, but managed to compose himself enough to help Grandpa up off the floor. Billy was slapping himself on his thigh so hard it stung. Rachel kept asking Grandpa if he was okay, and even though she tried to sound seriously concerned, her words were broken up by spurts of laughter. "Okay, that's it. We're all going out to dinner to celebrate. I'm buying," Rachel announced with a determined finality. "Let's go." Ron said they couldn't go out of the kitchen in such a turmoil, but Anna said just to leave it. Grandpa smiled and said he needed just a minute to wash up and change his shirt. Billy watched this all going on with his mouth wide open. His mother and father together, his father and Billy's grandfather's house, his grandfather actually laughing and smiling, Nana leaving a mess in the kitchen. This was not normal. Maybe something strange really had happened to him. It only took Grandpa a minute to clean up, and they all started to go out the front door. Ron opened the door and stopped in his tracks. The media had made it to Gardner, Maine. News travels fast in a small town. Flashbulbs were going off. Microphones were held high, hoping to grab a sound bite. Two TV cameras from Portland stations were poised just off the front steps. Billy poked his head through the grown-ups to get a better look. When he did, a flashbulb popped just a couple of feet from his eyes, and suddenly, it all came flooding back. Billy remembered, just like Dr. Matthews, had said could happen in a flash. Rachel spoke up for the family and explained that they were all just going out to dinner to enjoy some family time together, and they would all be glad to answer any questions and do interviews tomorrow, but not right now. Of course, that didn't stop the reporters from firing off questions and photographers from firing off flashbulbs. "Tomorrow," Rachel told all of them. That's all she said. The rest of the family, including Billy, just pointed to Rachel when reporters turned to them, and no one else said a word. Of course, a few of the reporters and photographers followed them to the restaurant. But when they saw it wasn't going to do any good, they left the family alone. Several of them handled Rachel's business cards and pressed for interview times. All they heard in response was, "Tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow." Billy was pretty quiet through dinner and dessert. Except that during dinner, Nana caught him looking at his mother with the softest eyes and the most pleasant smile she had ever seen on his face. On the way home, Billy announced matter-of-factly, "I remember what happened." Chapter 4, Billy's Story. So as soon as they came in, they all gathered in the living room. Billy sat on the couch, Ron sat beside him. Nana and Rachel sat on the floor by Billy's feet. Grandpa sat in his chair, and Billy began to tell his story. "Just as I fell through the ice, I took a big gulp of air and shut my eyes and my mouth really tight. I don't remember the water even being cold. I sank pretty fast, and then I came back up. But I hit the ice and couldn't find the hole I fell through. I tried to break the ice above me by hitting it, but I couldn't punch very hard through the water. I held my breath as long as I could, and when I finally let it go, it didn't go anywhere. Everything was quiet and dark for a little while, but then I saw this beautiful blue cloud with streaks of light coming up behind it. It was the most beautiful blue I had ever seen. Then the cloud disappeared, and all I could see was checkered light. It was like a bunch of icicles and circles that got bigger and bigger. And the light was reflecting off them, and the light was bouncing and sparkling all over the place. It looked like checkered light. That's all I could think. This went on for a long time until the checkered light stopped and everything turned black again, but only for a second. Then I saw lightning bolts flashing, and I heard the sound of a musical train. The sound was like a flute, but it was chugging like the rhythm of a train on the tracks. Ka-chug, 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 ka-chug. It was a happy sound, and I forget about the lightning bolts and just listen. When the music stopped, I noticed that I had this really funny, nice taste in my mouth. It was kind of like honey, but more like a fruit juice. I could taste it like I was drinking it, but I wasn't drinking anything. it was like it was coming from inside of me, and I could taste it everywhere. I mean, all inside my body, it was like I could feel it and taste it from my toes up to the tip of my tongue. It was sweet and delicious, and then he wanted to start laughing. The lightning came back after a while, but this time it was green and red and round. It flashed like lightning, but it looked like big round bumps full of light on a Christmas tree. The lights came and went over and over for a long time. And I saw this man, and it looked like he was glowing. It was like I was on this mountain. I could see big rocks and trees and a trail. The man was standing just off the trail. I was kind of floating, kind of walking toward him. When I got really close, he turned his head and looked along the trail. He didn't say anything to me, but I knew he wanted me to look down the trail, too. When I did, I saw a big light that was shaped like a great big egg. It was about 50 feet away from me. And the next thing I knew, I was inside this big egg-shaped light, and I was floating in it. And that's when God came. "Okay, that's enough for me," Grandpa said, as he jumped to his feet and headed for bed without another word, leaving the rest of the family in the living room. "I'm really tired, too, Billy," Rachel followed, and she stood up. Then she motioned for Ron to come with her in the kitchen. Anna didn't move a muscle. That is, until she heard Rachel call her from the kitchen. When Anna went into the kitchen, Rachel was standing there wide-eyed. Ron put his hands up in a helpless gesture. "Wow, we can't let Billy talk to anybody else about this," Rachel started. "They'll want to undergo psychiatric treatment. The press will make us look like a bunch of lunatics. I can't go on television. I'm not talking to them or anyone about this. And Billy's not going to talk to them either. Did you hear what he said? That's when God came." Anna didn't respond to Rachel. She turned and headed back into the living room. She found Billy fast asleep. He had a peaceful, beautiful smile on his face, so Nana carried him up to his room and tucked him in. Rachel carried on most of the night, drinking coffee and pacing the kitchen floor, repeating over and over, "We can't let Billy talk about this." Ron was kind of worried that she was losing it, but he was more concerned with Billy. Nana just let Rachel babble on, knowing things would take their course. Anna sure wanted to hear more about it. She was fascinated and couldn't wait to hear more of Billy's story. Anna finally asked Rachel what she was so upset about and why was so adamant about Billy not talking. Rachel had her reasons, but she didn't know how to talk to her mother about them, and she didn't want to. Out of sheer exhaustion, Rachel finally wound down and went to bed. Ron slept on the couch. Anna went up and tucked Billy in one more time and gave him a gentle kiss on the forehead. She was just happy that her Billy was home, safe and sound. Rachel wasn't too sure about the sound part. The next words heard in the house, "Billy, get up. Your breakfast is getting cold." When Billy came down to breakfast, Anna wasn't in her usual kitchen spot. Billy had never seen Anna sit at the kitchen table except to eat a meal, and then only after everyone else was seated. She was usually at the sink or at the stove, but this morning she was sitting down at the table, a cup of tea in front of her. Billy's breakfast was right where it always was, in perfect order, just the way he liked it. Grandpa had already left for work. Ron got up and left when he had Grandpa in the kitchen, and Rachel was still sleeping. "So what happened when God came?" Anna asked as Billy took his last sip of juice. Billy picked up right from where he had left off the night before. "It's really hard to put into words, Anna. I couldn't see God. I just knew that God was there with me. It was like I was being held like a baby. I was floating in this big cloud of light. It was like I was in a dream, but it was so real. God didn't speak, but I knew that everything was okay about everything. I was just so happy. I could feel so much love, and like God knew just who I was, and I knew that God was going to always be with me, right inside me. It was like I knew everything was always going to work out okay in life. Like God had a plan for me, my whole life. I knew in a weird way, it, almost like how everything worked in life. I don't mean like how the tea worked and stuff like that, but how everything fits into place like it's supposed to. I could feel that it's all perfect. Everything in life is perfect. Even when it seems really bad, it's still perfect in a way we don't understand. When we see the way God sees it, it's like there's no questions about anything anymore. Everything is answered and everything is okay. We don't have to freak out about anything, really, now. Anyway, the next thing I knew, it was like I was walking on a road. Well, it wasn't a road. It was more like a really long driveway. And I could see this really, really big house. It was like a castle, and it almost looked like it was shining because you could see the ocean behind it only about 100 yards away. Everything was shining. The trees and rocks and grass were so shiny and beautiful. I even stopped and sat down because I wanted to look closer at a blade of grass. It was so awesome. I could see these little tiny stripes in it and the way it was divided in half by this perfect groove. All I could think was that God just made the grass so beautiful, so perfect. And there was this little purple flower with yellow and white and a little black dot at the center. And So what about the castle? Nan asked eagerly. She didn't want to interrupt the story, but she couldn't contain herself anymore. She was really excited. The tea leaves reading she had done for Billy the day before popped into her mind while Billy was telling the story. But before Billy could answer, someone else spoke. So what's for breakfast? Rachel managed to get out through a big yawn and stretch. Nana jumped up automatically to accommodate Rachel, just like she did for everyone. Billy was looking straight ahead out the window over the kitchen sink. It was like he didn't even see his mother, and it looked like he had gone into a trance. But it was just like he was remembering every detail of what had happened to him so clearly as he told Nana about it. Then he almost shouted to Nana, who was just around the corner taking bacon and eggs out of the refrigerator, that he had to tell her about the lions. Billy, I need to talk to you, Rachel said seriously. Just finish your breakfast, okay? I got to have a coffee, and then we'll talk. What about the lions? Nana responded. She put the bacon and eggs on the kitchen counter. Ma, Rachel interrupted a little too loudly. Can it wait? Billy and I need to talk. So Billy went back to eating his breakfast. Nana started cooking another breakfast for Rachel. Nana didn't drink coffee, but she always made some for Grandpa, and there was still some in the pot. Rachel poured herself a cup and sat down at the kitchen table. You doing a garden this year, Ma? She asked. Of course. I got seedlings all ready to go. I'm going to plant a few more herbs this year. So going to can mustard, pickles, and tomatoes? No tomato canning. I read that cooked tomatoes aren't good for you. You should only eat them uncooked. Rachel made sure to keep Nana involved and talk about her garden while Billy finished his breakfast. Then she asked Billy to come into the living room. Nana knew a lot enough to leave them alone to talk. She'd have plenty of time with Billy later. Nana and Rachel were pretty classic mother and daughter opposites. Nana was a mama bear. She protected her children and her den fiercely. She cooked and cleaned and kept house. That was her role as she saw it. In addition to that, she kept close tabs on finances, making sure bills were paid on time. And that judiciousness spilled over into areas of her life as well. She liked life neat and orderly and predictable. She didn't like surprises. She considered herself something of a psychic, able to predict, know somehow what was going to happen, so she wasn't supposed to be surprised by anything, and to make sure she kept her life very orderly and organized. Now, Rachel, on the other hand, was a spontaneous free spirit. Her room was always in chaos. It would have frightened a pack rat, but she stepped over the pile and out of her room, looking like a princess, careful to shut the door behind her so no one else would see. No one would have guessed what turmoil went on inside her room and inside of her head. She left her marriage, and she left her son. She didn't do it carelessly or maliciously. She was just a restless free spirit looking for something. She wasn't sure what she was looking for, but she was sure she hadn't found it. Part of her was convinced that she never would. She felt like she was being punished for something that she had done when she was younger. It was her big secret, like so many of us have. She never shared it with anyone. She just put on this devil-may-care front, coming and going as she pleased. Whenever she popped in, unannounced, or whatever, she acted like she expected everyone to be delighted to see her. Whatever the circumstances had been of her last departure, to her that was history and had no relevance to her new adventure. And the truth was, because she was so gorgeous and sparkly, everyone was delighted to see her and usually eager to hear of her latest adventure. So Nana and Rachel had a few things to work out as Rachel grew up and matured. Well, the maturity part was always a pretty big question in Nana's mind. Rachel rebelled at any attempt to control very early, and she outlasted Nana on every issue, from picking up a room, or the not picking up a room, to what she wore and how she swore. She came into the world defiant and ready to stand her ground. She got that from her father. When Rachel first left Billy with Nana for several months and returned home, Nana tried to protect Billy from her, using Rachel's absence as an excuse for Nana to assert her role as surrogate parent over Rachel. That took one encounter to get straightened out permanently. You can't expect to come back here after being gone for 4 months and just take right over again. Billy has been with me all this time, and I'm more like a mother to him, Nana started. That was as far as she got with that one. For all the differences, Rachel had a bit of mama bear in her as well. She blasted Nana with both barrels, threatened to take Billy with her and never come back. Nana quickly called for a truce. She backed off then, and she would back off now. She let them go into the living room by themselves, handing Rachel her bacon and eggs as they left. Nana had given up on trying to get Rachel to eat at the table like everyone else. That was another small battle that Nana lost, too. She started cleaning up the kitchen and tried not to make too much noise so she could hear what Billy and Rachel were talking about. Billy, you have to promise me that you will not tell anyone else what happened to you or even mention. I mean, especially not mention what you said last night. You mean about God showing up? Rachel looked around the room like she expected for the place could be bugged already. She shook her head yes, and then she shook her head no in disbelief. Billy was confused. No, he asked. Yes, that, Rachel sighed. Mom, Billy spoke very softly, almost as if he was speaking to a child. It's okay. Everything is okay. It's okay that God showed up. Billy's soft response and the fact that he had a strangely calm, patronizing smile startled Rachel even more. Billy, God did not show up. Don't say that. People will think you're crazy if you say that. Come on, Billy, this is a small town. My God, what happened to you? God, was Billy's soft reply to her. I can't talk to you, Rachel said. She was so exasperated by the whole thing with Billy and so afraid that everyone would think that the whole family had gone nuts. You would have thought that Rachel wouldn't care what other people thought, being a free spirit and all, but, as I said, she had a real turmoil going on. She had put up a front to protect herself. She had a fear of being found out a phony, a princess with a messy room, and it went a lot deeper than that. Rachel carried a lot of guilt inside, and she didn't want to have anything to do with God. To her, God was a watchdog who just waited for everyone to mess up before condemning them to hell, and she knew she had messed up her life really badly, at least that's what she thought. She remembered the way her grandmother used to say to, oh, hell, give me another glass of wine, I'm going to hell anyway. The first time Rachel heard that, she was about 6 years old. She never forgot it. And when she heard about hell in Sunday school, she closed off a big piece of her heart because she felt so badly for her grandmother. When her grandmother died, Rachel was about 13. At the funeral, Rachel told God that she hated him. And to her mind, that meant she was going to hell too. From that point on, Rachel went from being a goody two-shoes to being a hellraiser. Whenever her conscience would bother, her grandmother's phrase about going to hell anyway would ring in. That was a big part of why she didn't want to hear anything about God. Now, not all of this was conscious to her, or right on her mind when she was talking to Billy. She just knew that she was terrified at the thought of her son being ridiculed, and Billy's casual and quiet demeanor about the whole thing frustrated her even more. Billy, please, was all she could say at this point. Well, why don't you talk to Nana, Billy started to say, but Rachel cut him off. I don't have to talk to Nana. I'm your mother, and I'm telling you. This time, Billy cut her off. He stood up and gave her a hug. Then he told her he didn't expect her to understand, but that he was supposed to tell his story. And yeah, that he had a lot more to tell. All right, you're on your own then, was how she responded to him at this point. She gave him a look that communicated utter disapproval, but she had no more to say. He gave her a verbal shot back, but he did it with a defiant look. That's nothing new. With that, Rachel went cold. She never touched her breakfast Nana had cooked for her. She just walked to her room, packed her bags, called a cab, and when it arrived, walked out the door without another word to anyone. Normally, at least up to now, Billy would have felt badly about the exchange with his mother, but this time he felt differently. He was just calm and peaceful inside. Even when he saw Rachel get into the cab, he didn't react any differently. He just went out to the kitchen and told his grandmother that his mother had left him a cab, and he just shook her head and kept on stirring the spaghetti sauce she was cooking. So do you want to hear any more of what happened, Billy asked her. Anna didn't say anything, but she stopped stirring. Rinsed the big wooden spoon and quickly dried her hands on her ever-present apron. Then she put on water for a cup of tea and pulled a chair up to the kitchen table across from Billy. He smiled at Anna and asked her where he had left off before they were so rudely interrupted. You said something about a castle, and then you said you were going to tell me about the lions, she reminded him. So Billy continued with his story. The big house that looked like a castle had two cement lions on the front step, one on each side. They looked really mean, and when I first saw them, they scared me. When I saw they weren't real, I just smiled at them. I was standing there smiling at the lions and feeling kind of silly because these lions weren't real lions. It scared me. But then one of them yawned and said, "Hi, Billy, how's it going?" I started laughing. I just broke up laughing because it was so weird and definitely because I was scared of him. Then I heard another voice say, "Don't let those lions scare you, Billy. They can't move off the steps and they won't bother you unless you stop to listen to them." When I turned around, I saw this man standing there. He was dressed in dark clothes and he had long dark hair. He had a really nice smile. I asked him how he knew my name was Billy, and he said that he was expecting me, and so was everyone else. I didn't know what he meant by that. He told me his name was William, and I said, "That's my name, too. Everybody just calls me Billy." By now, I had forgotten all about falling through the ice and the light and everything, and it just felt right to be here at the big castle, this big house. Somehow, I knew I was supposed to be there, or at least I didn't think about it. William made me feel safe. It was like he was there to protect me or teach me something. Anyway, I felt really good. It was like I was in a different world. Well, I guess I was in a different world. William put his arm around my shoulder and said, "Let's go inside. Everybody's waiting for you." I still didn't know what he meant, but I was feeling really good and happy, so I started up the front steps with William. As we went past the lions, the one on the other side of the steps winked at me and whispered, "See you later, Billy." I asked William if he heard that. He nodded his head and told me not to pay any attention to the lions. When we went inside, I could smell apple pie cooking. It's not just like yours, Nana. And I thought for a minute that I was back home, but I wasn't. This house was so big and bright with really high ceilings. I could hear music coming from somewhere, like the music I heard earlier when I fell through the ice. We went through a big kitchen and into a room like a porch. And the porch had big windows, and I could see the ocean about 100 yards away. When we stepped out on the porch, I saw a bunch of people sitting around a big long table, and some other people sitting in chairs, and a few people on a long blue couch. There were 11 people there. They all said, "Hi, Billy," at the same time. I don't know why, but I started laughing. I wasn't scared this time. It was like it was my birthday party or something. William told me, took me around to each person and introduced me. I'll tell you the names later when I tell you the stories they each had for me. William told me that while I was with them, I was going to hear 12 stories, one from each of the people I was meeting and one from him. And we're going to stop right there for today. Thanks for tuning in to Sundays with Papa Jeff, or for picking up the CD or the MP3. I hope you're enjoying Sunrise at Two Lions. It's available on my website at www.mindgoal.com, and it's also available through Amazon.com. Thanks for tuning in to Sundays with Papa Jeff, and until next time, we'll pick up from here.